I mean, it is Mondo. All right. So tonight we are continuing with a foundational teaching series, and I wanted to sit in a circle because we were talking at the Teachers Advisory Council meeting this last week, and just talking about the kind of, I don't know what to say, the format of teaching that, you know, we've been using lately. And once upon a time, if you've been here long enough, you probably came and we just passed a book around and read it. Pass and ready, read a little bit, and then we just kind of talk about some chapter that some other teacher wrote. And then people felt very free to just be like, well, I don't know, I don't really understand it, I don't like it, or whatever. So it was kind of more of a participatory conversation. But then, I don't know, there's people that didn't really like that. And I kind of felt like I should, I don't know, have something more to offer when there's like 25 people here than just like, let's read a book. So anyway, we moved away from that, but then of course, then you can end up skewing on the side of, you know, there's a talking head up front and everybody just goes, okay, what are we gonna learn tonight? And then just, you know, just kind of passively listening, which, I mean, that's kind of what you get to do during Dharma talks on Sunday. But I really feel like, you know, particularly because Tuesday tends to be more, in a way, more study-oriented, which is actually pretty also the case with, like, Christian churches. On Sundays, you go and you have, you know, your big mass or whatever the non-Catholics call it. And you know, you have Bible study or something on Wednesday nights, so... Anyway, so Tuesdays are more study-oriented, so I kind of wanted to make it more like we're studying this together. I mean, obviously, I've studied it a lot longer, more familiar with it. I can, you know, share things with it, but it's not really, none of it is very useful unless we really engage it ourselves and wrestle with it. So that's part of what my sense of study is about, is, you know, to a certain extent, it's just exposing ourselves to teachings. And some of them may appeal to us and some may not or whatever, but there's also an aspect of wrestling with the teachings. So, and this is what they are. What does that mean? What does that have to do with my life? And stuff like that. So, we're studying together. No question is stupid. The value of this is wrestling with the teachings, not just, you know, accepting them or passively listening to them. And in particular, this foundational teaching series, you know, there's lots of lists, lots of terminology, and, you know, for some of us, we love that. That's your thing, great. If not, then I just say, just let it flow one ear and out the other. Don't worry about it. And usually I think you'll find that something will stick, and, you know, it might not be tonight, but, you know, overall, something will stick and be like, come back to you and kind of resonate with something in your life. And so we're just kind of, we're exposing ourselves, and something might stick and be useful. So we are, this says one more class on mindfulness. And the popular definition of mindfulness, which many of you are probably aware of, is like kind of a awareness, and this is Kabat-Zinn, he says, awareness that arises through paying attention on purpose in the present moment, non-judgmentally. And then he says, I sometimes add in the service of self-understanding wisdom. So his is kind of a, it usually doesn't have a focal point, I guess. It's just kind of being mindful of the present moment. Now, in the Buddhist tradition, mindfulness is only one faculty that we need to fulfill the Eightfold Path. And mindfulness, the faculty of mindfulness, just to review, always has a subject or an object. And so the analogy that I used last week was like, mindfulness is like if you have a pair of binoculars and, you know, you're trying to really study a bird that's, you know, hidden in a bush. Like, mindfulness is remembering to aim it at the bird and being able to, like, keep it aimed at the bird for as long as possible and get distracted by something else. Oh, right, I wanted to pay attention to the bird. There's other faculties involved. You know, concentration might be, like, focusing with monoculars. And, you know, determination is, like, keeping your hands really still or something like that. But mindfulness is just that remembering to keep in mind. So in that sense, then there's right mindfulness. So it's not just about being mindful, that's a good skill, but it's also what are you being mindful of? So that's what the Buddha's teachings on mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness, it says these are the four things you should pay attention to or contemplate in order to, you know, fulfill the Eightfold Path. In order to, whatever you want to say, achieve liberation, awakening, etc. So just to review, those are body. So last week we talked about mindfulness of body. Then there's mindfulness of feelings, positive, negative, neutral. Mindfulness of mind, which we will talk about tonight as well. And mindfulness of phenomena, which really means mindfulness of how the Dharma operates. You know, so you're verifying the Dharma for yourself by careful observation of reality. So, let's see. So we did mindfulness of body last week. This week, feelings. So, feelings, in a Buddhist sense, are not complex emotions. It's like, dislike, and neutrality, which are pretty much viewed as like, we can't do much about them. We might be able to, you know, work on ourselves overall so that maybe dislike doesn't arise as much or in this particular situation, but kind of once it's arisen, it's not something that you have much of a choice about. So he says, and how monks, does a monk dwell contemplating feelings in feelings? Here, when feeling a pleasant feeling, a monk understands, I have a pleasant feeling. When feeling a painful feeling, he understands, I have a painful feeling. When feeling a neither pleasant nor painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands, I feel neither painful nor pleasant feeling. So, in that sense, so last week we talked a little bit about mindfulness, because it talks about mindfulness of the body in the body, and we're also supposed to contemplate feelings in, I mean, it's kind of an awkward phrasing, but contemplate feelings in feelings. So, I just was going to throw that open to what does it mean to contemplate feelings in feelings?
So is that like investigating why you're feeling what feelings are coming up?
Well,
what had you said before last week? You talked about being mindful of the body in the body, and this is being mindful of feelings in feelings. To me, it sort of feels like from that place of feeling, being mindful of the feelings that you're having, as opposed to analyzing them, or I don't know, there's just a flavor of something there.
Like being both inside and outside the thing at the same time?
Mm. I don't know, but for me, it's like this feeling of your feeling, and then being mindful of that feeling. Like I can feel it right now, actually, like feeling, like where feelings well up from, and then being mindful of that. I have to say though, you quoted that before. I don't remember when, and I for like a week practiced that. I am feeling a painful feeling. I am feeling a neutral feeling. Often when I was driving, because that's when I feel a lot of feelings that are painful. And it was interesting. It was very interesting how it changed things and how it diffused things and didn't get wrapped up going any further with it. So
what do you think that experience is? How is that? How is like sitting in the car and going like, I'm aware of a painful feeling, like different than how you ordinarily would?
Oh, definitely, because first of all, it was a little humorous, so it kind of took some of the heat out of it anyways. But then also it just stopped instead of, like someone cut me off, and then I have this whole story about them cutting me off and what that means about me, what it means about them, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Instead it was like, oh, I had a painful feeling, and then I can just keep driving and not get... spiraled down the rest of it. So
seems to me that the English language is deficient, because there's a feeling of pain, a feeling of cold, a feeling of heat. Are those the feelings we're talking about? Or are we talking about emotional feelings?
No, these are just feelings of like, dislike, and
neutral.
Okay.
So, I mean, painful, when they say painful, I don't think they mean... in the sense, if you have a pain, you probably also have a feeling of, I don't like that. But I don't think they mean painful. Sometimes it's not translated as painful. It's just pleasant or unpleasant or... Yeah, so it's just that sense of...
So it's not supposed to be anything more specific than that.
Just...
But you said into the more complex, like anger, jealousy, whatever.
Right, not
it's
that,
just that.
Just...
It's the base. It's a base feeling of those things.
Dislike, like, and... And kind of disinterest in a way, like kind of like, I don't really, you know.
It's almost at a sense level as opposed to some processing that happens after the fact.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't see it as a sense level at all. I see it as an emotional level. Because when we're talking about pain, hot, cold, those are sensory inputs. But when we're talking about dislike, like, or neutral, that's an emotional response to some other stimuli.
Right, but I guess my point is that there's not really a story around it. You haven't built a story necessarily. I mean, I don't know about you, but I can have a reaction pretty quickly without having a story.
Is that the difference she said between the body, what she was talking about last week, and feeling this week?
Well,
like what Bob was saying, the body is feels hot, cold, physical pain.
Right. Well, I mean, I think I, you know, it's just kind of a matter again of language. I mean, as I agree in a sense, this is emotional. It's just not. It's not the more complex emotions, which essentially are feelings plus a narrative. Right.
Good point. Yeah.
So that's the more complex emotions of like jealousy or disappointment or whatever. Those are more elaborate than this. Just kind of this kind of rising in the moment in reaction, like this, like neutrality or kind of indifference is more like if it's not hurting us. If we don't really like it, then we're not really invested. I don't know what's the use of identifying it at this basic level, do you think? Of being able to, because essentially that's what the teaching is saying, like build up the capacity and practice being able to identify those responses at this really, you know, fairly simple in the moment level.
So it gives you the ability to observe obstacles. Like if you can observe in yourself, like if you can examine which bits are the narrative and which bits are the feeling, it can help you identify which bits of that are an obstacle. Does that make sense? I may have misspoken.
No. I mean, I think like, yeah, like the being in traffic and like, you can see there's like a but, and then kind of being able to separate that out from the narrative.
It strikes me as strange. Do they really mean to consciously name these things?
Sounds like it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because it repeats over and over. I have a feeling of aversion. I have a feeling of attraction. I have a feeling of indifference.
Naming stuff's powerful.
Yeah, and there's that sense where if you're naming things, they're events that are coming and going.
Mm-hmm.
Which means you're identified with a stable background.
Mm.
And they're occurring in a foreground.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. So even maybe just the process of naming them turns them into things that are happening, which keeps you from sort of getting swept away with them.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like, come back to what something Pema Chodron always talks about is getting hooked. Like, you get down a spiral of whatever your reaction might be. Maybe it starts as just like a simple aversion to something, but then the story starts, right? And then it builds. And there's different points where you can sort of interject and maybe stop that process. And this would be one of the early points in that whole process, I think. That's the way I think of it, anyway. I have no idea if that's...
I also think it's human nature when you feel something to scramble around to try to, what is this I'm feeling? Do I need to solve it? Do I need to put my energy there? You know, that by itself can be exhausting. And if you have the language just to be like, oh, it's a pleasant feeling, this is not a pleasant feeling, you know, type of thing, it shortcuts that too. It gives you a language to identify it.
Yeah, I mean, I know for me it ends up being, I don't know, just as an example, like being in a meeting and, you know, someone ends up, you know, expressing themselves or whatever in a way that I'm like, oh, you know, got over this already, you know, so there's a feeling of impatience. But, you know, there's just, at a very basic level, there's a sense of not liking. Like, I don't like what's happening. And I don't know, somehow, like you're saying, like, just identifying that, and maybe it's because, I don't know, you're kind of like stepping out of the experience. Like, it's like you're focused on, when you're really caught up in it, you're focused on what you think is making that happen. And when you shift it to the feeling, I don't know, there's more space around it. I can go like, okay, I don't really like this. Okay, no. How are you doing with that? You think you can survive? You know, as opposed to then, like, I've got to start thinking about how this person isn't, you know, and this whole thing isn't working, you know.
Well, I think it helps you really be present to it as well, because rather than just reacting, you're kind of stopping and just, oh, I don't like this, you know.
Yeah.
And so you kind of stop there, and rather than reacting or responding or taking action or whatever, I think it helps you to be present more.
Or you could tune out.
Oh, yeah.
Which is not feeling anything, I think.
We're just ignoring everything.
Pushing it down. Yeah.
That's not exactly being present. Mm-hmm. But
I think I'm still struggling with the concept of having just these three pure feelings. It's like car. You know, Mark says, look, there's a car, and I can't see what he's looking at. And I get this impression in my head of a car, and it might be a blue car, red car, green car, silver car, four-door, two-door. It's not specified. It's all just very generic. And so when we have this concept of car in my head, even if I don't know what he's talking about, I come up with a generic example of car. It's a silver car, four-door, you know, going down a hill. That's what comes up in my head. So I'm not sure what these three are supposed to be doing. I don't know how to use them. I don't know what we're dealing with here, because it's totally unspecified for me.
What are the teachings wanting you to achieve? Mm. I mean, by understanding it, is it wanting you to be able to understand these things so that you have a non, so you don't react?
Okay.
Good question. I mean, you know, what are we aiming for here?
Right.
Ultimately liberation.
Right. Right. Liberation.
But, you know, liberation also in the moment.
Mm. I don't know, Ted, if you're asking if what's the teaching beyond just this little segment of it? Is it part of a bigger teaching?
Yeah, what is it ultimately wanting you to do with the teaching?
Well, isn't it to be present?
Uh-huh.
To be present all the time.
Uh-huh.
You know, be mindful all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so it's sort of a practice.
Dissecting mindfulness, right? Uh-huh. That's the, I mean, that's where all this comes from, is this idea of like, this is how you follow the Eightfold Path with regards to mindfulness.
To change behavior.
Well, this is how you follow the Eightfold Path, period. This is when the Buddha was asked, how do you do this? How do you awaken? How do you follow the Eightfold Path? You say, well, let me tell you about the four foundations of mindfulness. So this is the Buddha. This is original Buddhist practice.
So is it just a sentence without any elaboration?
Oh, yeah. No, there's a whole sutra.
Oh, okay.
So that's basically the whole thing about, and what do I mean by,
okay.
So it's mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of mind, which we'll get to, and then mindfulness of essentially verifying the Dharma for yourself by mindfulness of phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it'll make a bit more clear as we go on and cover the other things.
Okay.
But I mean, to some extent, this is like, on the one hand, you could look at this as like you're building your mindfulness muscles, I guess, mm-hmm. paying attention to simple things, and yet, I don't know, there's more to it than that. Because you're learning something at each stage also. Like last week we were talking about mindfulness of the body in the contemplating death, sitting in a charnel ground and contemplating mm-hmm. death. So it's not just that you're learning mindfulness so you can apply it later to something that's important. I mean, you're actually practicing mindfulness of something that is
In and of itself
right. is valuable.
Yes.
That you learn something from, like, so in that, you know, I guess mindfulness of, you know, contemplating the impermanence of the body helps us be less attached to the body, ideally. Mindfulness of feelings, I guess you would say the similar thing is not, because in other places he talks about like the, what we're trying to stop doing is the habit of I, me, and my making.
Mm-hmm.
And so the problem is all of these things, we identify with all these things. We identify with the body. We identify with the feeling. So this basic sense of like and dislike is just this flash. And then, you know, it immediately develops into, you know, it has a context, it has a reason, it has a story, it has all that kind of stuff. So it's, you know, it's helping us pay attention at that really basic level and not not be so identified, I guess. If I dislike something, that doesn't necessarily mean I have to do something about it.
I was thinking of your car example. I had a short lunch break today, and I drove my friends to lunch. And I got stuck behind a Prius that was going 10 miles an hour on the speed limit in gridlock.
That's what Priuses do.
Before there's a story about, you know, what is up with this clown, there's this sense of like, ugh, right? It's pre-verbal, it's preconceptual. And I actually followed along behind him for the better part of a mile, feeling this like, ugh, and then, you know, but because I was aware that it was, you know, just sort of a negative, irritable feeling, I didn't get swept up in it. And then, you know, I looked at my buddy and said, save the environment faster. It didn't have to turn into road rage.
That's great. And I guess there's also a section before we go on to contemplation of mind. There's also a section at the end of this, where it at the end of the section on contemplation of feelings, where it talks about contemplating the arising and passing of feelings. So that's another aspect to all of the, I mean, like just like contemplating impermanence of the body. Essentially, once you can start to notice these, like dislike, neutral, basic impulses in a way, then you can notice how they can pass. I mean, whatever, you know, there I am irritated in a meeting, and I just like chill, and you know, 5 minutes later I don't remember it. So then it begins to realize, like, these things pass. So and there's a certain kind of thing where, like, if we're less likely to identify as self something that just changes in 5 minutes. So I don't know if anybody has any comments about that. Have you experienced that, of like noticing the arising and passing?
It's a way of not being personalizing. You're like, I don't like that person because they're bringing up the thing that we've already gone over in the meeting. Right. It's just like, oh, we've been over this. You know, it has nothing to do with the person.
And I don't like that.
Yeah, so you just let it be that. That's it.
Yeah. That's an interesting thought too. Like it can be a taking responsibility for your own responses. Mm-hmm. I don't want to talk about this again. This is stupid.
So it is like I guess to use the Zen term, so like turning the light around. Okay, what is my experience? And
I think it comes back again a little bit to this idea of short-circuiting the story, the narrative, and all the crap that happens after. You know, like, I don't like what's being said. Oh, therefore I hate this person. Right? Yeah. You don't have to go there.
Right. It even, I feel like, diffuses some of the importance too. I don't like what's being said.
So what?
Oh, well. Yeah. Do I like it or not like
that
it?
That doesn't sound nearly so important. It's like, Lucy is always trying to overtake our meetings.
Right.
Yeah, you impute it with all this meaning. And
So let's see. Let me go on to mind. Because this is a little more specialized. So as we contemplate mind, these are the specific things that we are invited to pay attention to. So, this is basically the presence or absence of greed, hate, and delusion, which are, you know, lust, desire, whatever, hate, aversion, anger, and delusion. So, noticing that, there's aversion arising in my mind, or there's you know, grasping or desire arising in my mind. Noticing when the mind is, so this is kind of presence, absence. And then noticing when the mind is constricted or contracted. When it is distracted or scattered. Enlarged or not, unsurpassed or not. So noticing when the mind, you know, the mind feels enlarged, or it does. It's not. My mind feels unsurpassed, or it doesn't feel that way. Concentrated.
This is a hard one. I don't understand.
Well, we have to talk about it. What could that mean? Concentrated and or liberated. Liberated or released. And I'm sure that there are very detailed descriptions of what these are in the Pali Canon, but I didn't look them up because I figured we'd just speculate. But for a moment, I'll just read a few. It says, so how does a monk dwell contemplating mind in mind? A monk understands a mind with lust, or the greed, as a mind with lust, and a mind without lust, as a mind without lust. A mind with hatred, as a mind with hatred, and a mind without hatred, as a mind without hatred. He understands, and same with delusion, he understands a contracted mind as contracted, so it's essentially recognizing, oh, my mind is contracting right now. And a distracted mind as distracted. He understands an exalted mind, so that's his word for enlarged, exalted, as exalted, and an unexalted mind is unexalted. So there's unsurpassed or unsurpassable versus not, concentrated versus not, liberated or released. And wild guesses?
The two that I enlarged and unsurpassed, there's some like working definitions of what that means. Like, what's an unsurpassed mind?
I'm guessing. I'm guessing that that's referring to essentially. Words to it, but I guess if you imagine, you know, at your peak moments, whether you've been meditating or other moments, and you've just felt like, you know, your mind is spacious and feels connected and it's kind of calm and open and perceptive and all of that, like it's. Probably not unsurpassed, because there's probably more, like it could get more spacious, it could get greater equanimity, but there's a sense that, you know, how enlightened is your mind? that's what I'm thinking. And that essentially, until complete Buddhahood, our mind is not unsurpassable. There's always... It's talking about that sense of being able to recognize how exact differentiation between that and constricted would be. That seems kind of overlapped, but you know, if it's not unsurpassed, it would still be kind of limited. limited in our perception or our level of acceptance or something.
Okay.
And enlarged, I don't really know the difference.
Well, I don't know, is an exalted mind something too, is that a good thing to be?
Yeah, I mean, that's what, you know, Bhikkhu Bodhi, that's what he did, his translation is exalted. So honestly, I'm not really sure. I mean, because I was kind of describing that in unsurprised. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure exactly how those are differentiated. But I think we have a good sense of what they're pointing toward, even if we don't know which one exactly.
The last four items on the list all kind of feel like the same thing to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe not concentrated, but concentrated is different. Concentrated versus unconcentrated?
I think of concentrated as, I mean, there is, you know, concentrated on this one subject, but there's, I think of concentrated as being undistractable, right? Like, you know, you can be concentrated on a very broad thing. It's that feeling of rootedness.
And that might just kind of come along with some of these other ones, then?
That's the way it feels to me.
I'm curious about constricted and contracted. I mean, I'm not sure. Are we talking about our thoughts being constricted, like closed-minded? You know?
I mean, you know, it's...
I'm trying to understand that one.
Yeah.
I mean, there's... That word's very evocative for me. There are certain things that trigger quasi-obsessive behavior for me. And when my mind goes that way, it really does feel stuck, right? And it does feel like there's not room to get off this topic. So I don't know if I've got the right feeling for that one, but that is a very evocative term for me.
And these are, I mean, trying to describe and put language to and parse out experiences are, you know, and subjective experiences is, the Indians did a pretty good job. But,
well, there's translation too, which I always,
Yeah. But I mean, these are mind states. So it's kind of bigger than, you know, individual thoughts and stuff. Mm-hmm. But like, maybe it's kind of like your mind weather, maybe.
I was just thinking about like the difference between weather and climate. Like a climate in a country is a certain way, but like the weather can be the things that shift throughout the day.
Or a posture. There's a thing that I think of recently a lot when I read Fukan Zazengi is first he describes a posture of the body and then he describes a kind of posture of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
So would you describe these as posture of the mind?
Well, but some of these, I mean, maybe these are like, in a sense, these are postures we might aim for, but he also says we should be able to recognize when our mind state is not like that.
Mm-hmm.
So when our mind state feels the opposite of exalted or the opposite of concentrated, unconcentrated.
And is this again, let's name them but not necessarily do anything with them past that?
Yeah, I mean, that's what the practice at this point is just being able to recognize and, you know, be mindful of them, be able to, like, you get them in your binoculars and pay attention to them.
Yeah.
And presumably become familiar with them as well.
So this is just going further than just comfortable and uncomfortable or whatever.
Right. So that was the feeling. So we did the feelings, and now we're kind of mind states. And it's still a little, we're never focusing on like the content.
Right.
The narrative, the what it is that made us feel this way or something. We're just kind of being aware of our own experience.
So one thing I'm struggling with this whole concept of like these items is, you know, there's kind of like this neutral or what I'd call default mind state, which doesn't really seem to fit in any of these categories. Then I had the thought, well, maybe my neutral mind state is one of these categories. I just don't know it. Do you know what I mean by that? Like,
it would probably be scattered. In terms of a Buddhist, mine is.
Okay.
Like that in the Buddhist terminology, I think it would be called like our default mind state, which is like when we're not busy with something or being entertained, we're kind of like just rehearsing stuff.
I see what you mean by that. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just thinking it's very hard to be mindful of not being mindful. Scattered.
I'm sensing something interesting in the term constricted. Mm. I feel that is like an outside force doing the constricting. Everything else is something that the mind does of its own volition. But constricted means that something's, you know, got a hold of it and is squishing down on it. That's just the feeling I'm getting out of that concept.
You know, I was having the same feeling about distracted.
I see.
You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Something comes along, a bird flies.
Yeah, the cat with the laser pointer.
What's that?
The cat with the laser pointer.
Oh, that cat is focused, though.
Yes, but you are the one doing the distracting. The mind is not doing it to itself.
Sure. I generate my own laser pointer. For sure.
Well, and I think that's why... that's kind of one category. This is kind of one category. And this is one category.
Mm-hmm.
Of like... Yeah, kind of noticing. And I think then the practice is, you know, just whatever. Our eyes follow the laser pointer, and then we just go noticing a distracted state of mind. And that there is value in just being able to do that, regardless of what led up to that, in a way that, oh. And then maybe if we notice we have a distracted state of mind or a constricted state of mind, then maybe we can make some decisions to have a you know, more liberated state of mind. Maybe there's something that we can do, but I don't know. For me, this is the big one comes up. It's not on this list, but I'm sure, I guess, depressed. And then probably the opposite of exalted. Mm. Be an unexalted mind, perhaps. Of just, and that's...
It, maybe.
Yeah, where, you know, kind of slipping into that mind state, and it's just like... It's only if you can recognize, oh, that my mind is constricted right now. I am experiencing something, as opposed to, because otherwise you're looking out at all the reasons to feel miserable, right? But when we become aware of the mind state, then it's a different relationship to it. I find anyway that if I can recognize that's happening, I'm not quite as caught.
Yeah, so the way I think about this is I'll wake up in the middle of the night and become obsessed about something at work or some person or whatever. I'm not aware of that at all. I'm just so wrapped up in this thing, this situation or whatever it is, and I can't, you know, get down to what the actual feeling is. So... So, in that respect, this is very helpful.
Yeah.
It brings you down out of all this stuff that is not going anywhere anyway. So,
and then we do it, also, it is true, John Kabat-Zinn, you know, was correct in some aspects of it, where we need to do this non-judgmentally, mm-hmm. kind of just like, as opposed to like, no, I shouldn't feel that way, or I've got to get rid of that feeling or something, because that doesn't really, that doesn't really work in the same way. It's just like, so we just have a few minutes left, so just in the interest of exposing you to the full Dharma, I'll just tell you what the mindfulness of the contemplation of phenomena. And it's really weird. This terms talking about translations. There's one translation the translator really liked calls this contemplation of mental qualities. And all I can figure is he means, you know, from the Buddhist point of view, like our mind colors everything. So in a sense, this isn't really contemplation of phenomena. This is contemplation of our own minds, but not in this way. But anyway,
right.
So it says a monk dwells contemplating phenomena in phenomena. First, so there's several different sections of this in terms of the five hindrances. So we just studied the five hindrances: desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt. So in this case, it said the monk dwells contemplating phenomena and phenomena in terms of the five hindrances. And how does he do that? When there is sensual desire in him, a monk understands there is sensual desire in me. Or when there is no sensual desire in him, he understands there is no sensual desire in me. And he also understands how unarisen sensual desire arises, and how arisen sensual desire is abandoned, and how abandoned sensual desire does not rise again in the future. So this is like taking it, you know, a step further, right? So we're not now just recognizing it's present, which you know, is still valuable. We've been talking about how it is valuable, but like a even more sustained investigation of noticing, you know, how did this arise? You know, how long is it lasting? You know, what am I doing perhaps that is allowing this to pass away and not become a hindrance anymore? Again, like we said, desire isn't necessarily a hindrance, but if it is a hindrance, how do we let go? And then how do we make it? How do we practice so that this doesn't become so much of a hindrance in the future? Mm. And then we do the same thing with ill will and the other hindrances. So this, I feel like this is we can do this kind of practice all day.
Endlessly, yes.
Whenever a hindrance arises, you know, how did this arise? And, you know, yeah, just have a few minutes left, so I'll just say, then we go on to contemplating phenomena in phenomena in terms of five aggregates, subject to clinging. So that is form, sensation, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And then as we're contemplating the five aggregates, which are basically, they're meant to represent like all aspects that we could possibly identify as self. Mm-hmm. As opposed, you know, not including like relationships and possessions and stuff, but and anything that you could identify as you. My body, my consciousness, my intentions, my thoughts, my feelings, my, you know, and saying, you know, none of that is self. So then what do we study? The monk understands such is form, such is its origin, such is its passing away. Such as feeling, such as its origin, such as its passing away. So again, it's examining the impermanent quality of all of these things, so that we're not identified, we don't cling to them as so much as part of self. And then there's the six sense bases: eye and the things that the eye sees, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. So all of the things that we kind of between, you know, the, for something to happen, there has
sense doors.
Yeah, there has to be a sense, and there has to be something to sense, and the interaction between the two. So here the monk understands the I, he understands forms, and he understands the fetter that arises dependent on both. So I interpret that as like recognizing the attachment that arises through our sense, including mind and thought. So it really examining our interactions with the world and how it leads to attachment. And then there are the seven enlightenment factors, which this is one where you become to learn to recognize these enlightenment factors within you and whether or not they are present. And those are mindfulness. This is one of those fractal things, right? Of mindfulness is discrimination of phenomena, energy, rapture, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. So that's a whole another class, right? Of like rapture. Who would have thought rapture was like a enlightenment aspect of enlightenment factor, as they say. And then finally, once you've learned to recognize those and help them, like just like the hindrances, now you want to help these things arise. Then a monk contemplates dwelling phenomena in terms of the Four Noble Truths. So that's the last part, and that is essentially really, really, you know, because now you have the power of mindfulness. You have the power to like pay attention to something and stay focused on it long enough so that you can see how dukkha arises and how it arises through desiring things to be other than how they are, and if you let go of desiring things for other than how they are, dukkha can be let go. So
is this the kind of thing that you did when you were in the monastery?
No. I mean, we studied it in our... We had a seminary class, so it was kind of like this, just exposing us to the teachings and, you know, you either remembered or you didn't, but... But yeah, no, we didn't really use it. And I was curious, I did a podcast episode on this a ways back, and I did the first podcast episode on really the four foundations of mindfulness, and then the second one was on like, well, how do we do this in Zen? And usually all of this stuff just shows up in different ways. So I think it just shows up in, this just shows up in a more organic way, I guess. We're not as systematic about it. Like, no. Where are you with the four foundations of mindfulness? Well, I'm studying the second noble truth. You know, we're just more like, over the course of our day, you know, we learn to look at the arising of dukkha and recognize how letting go can free us from it. And but actually, this is really cool. I'll just end with this. So then, because this is like, it sounds like a really gradualistic kind of, you know, you'd be working on this for a long time, right? You get your mindfulness, and I mean, frankly, concentration is hard, so most of us will just be stuck at mindfulness of the body forever, you know? So he says, Buddha says, if anyone should develop these four establishments of mindfulness in such a way for 7 years, one of the two fruits could be expected for him, either final knowledge here and now, or if there's a trace of clinging left, non-returning. So these are different levels of attainment. But then he says, if you should develop them, like really develop them, in such a way for 6 years, or five, or four, or three, or two, same deal, let alone 1 year, for a few months, let alone half a month. So days, 7 days. And I think what this is pointing to is that, I mean, there's a sense that it's gradual. Yes, I mean, we all have work to do, but there's also a sense that if you really just could, if you just could grok this stuff, liberation is yours. And that's kind of where the Zen point of view is. It's like, we don't have, there is gradual work to do, but it's not, we're not only going to get the rewards after X number of years. Like, in this moment, you can recognize the arising of a hindrance and not be as caught by it. So, like, in a way, the payoff is all along the way. So I figured that would be a good place to leave it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you all.
Thank you.